Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Let's start off. Let's talk a little bit about choice. What is choice? What are we talking about when we're talking about choice?
So philosophically, right, and we have some set of options before us, right? At any given moment, there's several things we could do. And the question is, what are we actually going to do? And psychologists have been interested in this question really since the beginning of the field, even with studies on animals trying to figure out, you know, are they going to go left or right and what factors are going to influence that. And so fundamentally, this has been one of the central areas of research in psychology for the last, 110 years.
And I think, even before there was psychology, I mean, the precursors of psychology, philosophy and so-called natural philosophy, I mean, people have always wondered, why do people behave the way we behave? Psychologists sort of expanded that to think about animal behavior as well. But, philosophers, as all the way back to Aristotle, have imagined not only what do we choose to do, but what ought we choose to do. And I think the interesting thing that we're going to talk about tonight is all of that is predicated on the notion that most of what we do is a result of our making choices. And I'm sure what our goal is tonight is to disabuse you of that misperception. Even though within our own consciousness, it feels like what happens most of the time is we operate in the world and information comes in from our sense receptors. We process that information, we make decisions, and then we act. And it does feel like that's what's happening. But as Art says at the beginning of every show, most of the time we have no idea why we're doing what we're doing. And one of the things that we're really good at as human beings that many animals are not, because we have this lovely frontal lobe that's the last part to evolve in the human brain, is that we're great at making up stories to explain our past behavior. And sort of a joke in psychology and neuroscience, which isn't really much of a joke, is that one of the primary purposes of the frontal lobes is to come up with post hoc rationalizations for why we've done what we've already done.
So let's talk a little bit about, I know we're not going to get to everything, and you guys have tons of questions, so we're going to leave a lot of time for that. But one study I love is the cake study, because it shows how all of these outside influences are making us make different choices, or influencing the way that we make choices. So talk a little bit about that.
Okay, I'll do it as briefly as I'm capable. So, when our brains, which is I'll be
Art
here about
laughs,
an hour.
Like yeah, he never talks.
We've done about eight. When you think about the parts of the brain that are the most recent evolutionarily, that make us human beings, that give us consciousness, all those kinds of things. When those things developed, they didn't replace the old stuff, right? That are the parts of our brain that are present in many so-called lower animals. They just grew on top of it. So our brains have different components that are competing in some ways for the decisions that we happen to make. And Rebecca is referring to a study that we've talked about, I think, several times on the show, that show the fragility of our conscious minds in making decisions. So in this particular experiment, people showed up at a room to participate in a study, and I'm sure they were the ubiquitous undergraduate college students who participate in every psychological study. So anyway, they showed up at the room, and actually the room that they showed up to wasn't where the experiment was going to be. A proctor was in the room and said, okay, sent down some personal data, and they said, I'm going to give you a subject number now, and I want you to walk down the hallway to the next room on the right, and that's where you'll actually do the study. Actually, that was a lie. The study actually happened in the hallway. So they were given each subject was given either a two-digit number or a six or seven digit number. I don't remember what the exact number was. They walked out in the hallway, and the proctor said, I want you to remember this number, and when you go down the hall, tell the person in the other room what your subject number is, and then they'll do the experiment. So when the person walks out the hall, there's a confederate, which means somebody who's in on the experiment, but unbeknownst to the subject, came up with a tray with treats on it. There were some little plastic cups with chocolate cake and little plastic cups with grapes. And the person comes up and says to the subject, we have some extra stuff. We had a reception, and would you like a snack on their way to the other room? Now remember, some subjects are remembering a two-digit number. Some subjects remember a six or seven-digit number. And the dependent measure in the study was who picked the cake and who picked the grapes. And the people who were asked to remember a longer number were several times more likely to choose the chocolate cake than the grapes. Now what explains this? Well, you know, when our brains evolved, some resources were very scarce. I mean, there wasn't a lot of sweet things around. Weren't a lot of salty things around. Surely wasn't any chocolate around, right? There weren't a lot of fatty things around. So what our brains evolved to think is when you see that stuff, you shove as much of that into your face as you can, because that didn't come around very often, not imagining there would be a McDonald's every block, right? So now I'm trying to remember a six-digit number, and my brain's busy. My conscious brain is busy with that number, you know, 13725, 13725. Well, that's only 5 digits, isn't it? Whatever. Anyway, my brain's trying to remember that number. And now the part of my brain that's more primitive is thinking, cake, and I take the cake, right? Now, when I'm remembering 2 digits, that allows my conscious brain to say, you know, you don't really need cake. You know, take the grapes or just pass on the whole thing. But that's how fragile it is. We can occupy our conscious minds with something that small, and suddenly the more primitive parts of our brain take over our decision making.
And one of the things I love about these kinds of studies, of course, if you ask people later, why did you choose the cake? Nobody says, well, because I was trying to remember a 6-digit number. And there's and so all of these kinds of stories that we tell after we've made a decision are a reflection of factors that influence the decision itself. So another set of studies I really love, they have people make decisions about things like backpacks. So, you know, you got, again, it's college students. So what do they care about? They care about backpacks. So you say, you know, so they're evaluating these backpacks, and one of them is slightly better than the other. And often what they'll do is they'll make sure that one of them is in a color that someone would really like. And so that gives a very slight initial preference for one of the backpacks over another. But initially, when they're thinking about the backpacks, basically they really think that all the features of each backpack are pretty good, and they're having a hard time deciding. As the decision process moves forward, and remember, this decision process is being started just by something very small like the color that isn't really the central part of the choice. You know, people don't want to say, well, I made this big, you know, $90 decision because I like that color better. So what happens is, over time, they start reevaluating all of the features. Now they start thinking, oh, I really want the one with the 3 zippers on it. That's really important to me. And I want the one that has 9 pockets instead of 8, because that's really important to me. And so what happens is, over time, the features of the thing you like better to start with become more important to you. You start telling yourself, the reason I'm doing this is because of those features, rather than because of some of the things that are actually driving the decision. And studies like this get extraordinarily scary in election years like this.
And tell us why.
You know, it's an interesting thing that we like to think of ourselves as clear-headed thinkers who make decisions based on objective information. But everyone who works in marketing realizes that that's a fallacy. And what we should be doing is exploiting the things that people respond to emotionally first. And then we might lay out some details that actually provide some information. And I think most of us are most of the time convinced that what we're basing our decisions on are information. And we even tell people, you know, get a legal pad, make a list of pros and cons, and make your decision with the idea in mind that once the information is there, then that's going to drive my decision. But, you know,
and of course, you all do that.
Yeah. but of course, what we know, and what Art and I will talk about several times tonight, is our great capacity for self-delusion. And I, you know, in many ways, it's understandable that we would have that capacity, because after the fact, I mean, after we make decisions, and now the decision is in the background, it's in history now, well, why would we, you know, be miserable about it? So we find ways to make the decision justifiable in terms of facts that weren't on the table when we were making the decision.
And one of the fundamental problems is, actually, what fascinates me about marketers is they don't even need to do a good job of reaching to the emotional level. All they need to do is to show you the product right here. We could because the reason for that is because just being exposed to something makes you like it better. So probably the scariest study I ever read, they showed people an ad for a pen, like one of these expensive pens, And then they showed the ad, and then later they gave people a choice between that pen, which was described by its various features, but then a picture of the pen, and a second pen described by a different set of features, and they had a separate group of subjects who didn't see the ad, who looked at the two pens and the features and said, this second one, the one that people hadn't seen an ad for, that second one is better. Everyone who didn't see the ad picks the other pen. Everyone who did see the ad picks the pen they saw the ad for, even though the other one has better features. Why? Because they've seen it before. Okay, just being exposed to something makes you like it better. And if you don't believe this result, ask yourself what happened the last time you went to a rock concert. What is the song that everybody cheers for? The one that's been on the radio. Why? Is that the objectively the band's best song? No, it's just the one you've heard before.
And I think one of the things that we underestimate is how much the ability to recall something, the ability to recognize something, influences our attraction to that thing, whatever it happens to be. I mean, we know, and Art and I have talked about this in several different contexts, you know, companies put their names on stadiums. I mean, it's very expensive to do that. And why does Staples want to be the Staples Center, right?
I mean, I got this.
It doesn't tell you anything about Staples. It doesn't tell you anything about the product is any good or not. It doesn't tell you it's a good store. It's just that now that name is familiar. So you're thinking office products.
Got to think Staples. I got that. That's
you
got that.
Well, so the thing is this, though. I mean, we've been doing this show for a few years, and we've done a lot of discussions on choices that we make and we think we're rational and we're not. Is there a way for us to kind of have a Ulysses contract with ourselves to make more clear, rational, thoughtful judgments about things because we know that we wouldn't necessarily do that?
So we do need to plan in advance. Right. So let's think about certain kinds. So one of the things we know about decisions is it can be very difficult to make decisions about doing the right thing in the long term over doing something that's good for us in the short term. So there's an example of where we plan in advance to protect ourselves from ourselves. So, for example, we have retirement accounts. Right, where we put money away for our future now so that we won't get our grubby little fingers on it. And we also sometimes engage other people to help nag us when we're about to do the wrong thing. So for example, if you know that you're a shopper who overspends, then you need to bring somebody along with you. Because one of the things that happens when you're shopping is
Not your kid.
No.
No.
Someone you trust to talk you down.
And a cheap person.
And a cheap person. Because in the moment in which you are in the thrall of whatever you're going to buy, you just want that thing. I mean, think about what happens. Why do car dealers want you to test drive cars? Because the moment you sit down in the car, it's your car. That's my car. And at that point, it's all downhill to the sale from there. So when you really feel that pull of the option, you need somebody else there who doesn't feel the pull of that option, who can give you advice about what you ought to be doing at that moment. And if you can't find somebody to help you to do that, then one of the things you should do is to imagine before you make the purchase that you're advising somebody else about whether they should make the purchase. And sometimes just creating that distance will help you to lessen the excitement about the thing that you're looking at the moment.
But all of this is still focusing on the idea that the best decisions are those that are cool-headed and just based on fact. And I think one of the things we ought to spend a little bit of time on tonight is the fact that, you know, all of our decision-making is influenced by what's in our memory. And a lot of what's in our memory is inarticulable. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we've experienced.
As anyone who's listened to the show knows.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. What the hell did they say? I don't know. But there's a lot of what we experience that gets into our memory. And we can't really explain not only the thing that we're thinking about, but we can't explain the relationships among the things that we're thinking about. You know, in a lot of things, when musicians are evaluated in some formal way, there are a lot of instruments that are designed to help us do that. And they have different components of musicianship that are listed on the instrument, with the idea in mind that all those things exist apart from the others, and they sum to a total that is the same thing as a human experience. And they don't, right? I mean, sometimes there's some things that matter a lot in some circumstances, and in other circumstances they don't. And a lot of things that if this is present matter a lot, but if this isn't present, that doesn't matter at all. It's really hard to explain all that. It's really hard to write all that down. But our brains, quite remarkably, can figure out not only what variables matter, but what the relative importance of all the variables are in relationship to one another. So the question is, do we kind of throw out what we refer to as gut instinct, right? And the short answer is no, we don't at all. Now, by gut instinct, I'd probably explain what I mean. I don't mean, you know, signals from your digestive system. I mean that the things that you can't articulate why that seems better to me. Because there are instances where the combination of things that are in our memory do actually inform us in an advantageous way of why that choice is better than that choice, right?
Right, provided that you have some control over what's in your memory. Yeah. And so one of the fundamental problems that we face in the modern world is that we have ceded control over our information environment to other people, right? So people pay for that. And so if you don't know what who's paid to get in your head, then you can't correct for that. And so that's one of the reasons why advertising is a dangerous thing in terms of decision making, because you don't recognize when somebody has paid to get in there. And then people will say all the time, oh, well, I don't really pay attention to the ads. Actually, it turns out not paying attention to the ads is the worst thing you can do. Because then the information gets into your head because you glance at the TV at some point, or you hear the theme song or whatever it is. But because you're not really paying careful attention to it, you don't remember when and where you saw it. And so now you get to the store and you just think, wow, this thing's really cool. I don't know why. It must be because it's good. So actually, if you're going to expose yourselves to ads, really pay attention to the fact that you're watching an ad so that you remember when you see that product later, oh, one of the reasons I'm getting a little boost from this is because they keep advertising this.
You know, unlike scholarly papers, our brains don't have citations.
That's right.
So whatever piece of information is in our head, there's not like a source, you know, like where I got that. In fact, most of us have no idea where we got most of the information that we have in our heads. Now, again, there's probably, in our distant past, not an evolutionary advantage to having a citation for all the information that we have. If you have the information, that's a good thing. But now, as I was saying, you know, we have advertisers whose motives are different from ours. Their intention is to influence our behavior in ways that we may not fully understand. And as Art's saying, focusing on what you're seeing and not sort of trying to keep it under the radar actually makes you more cognizant of where information comes from.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about, before we open things up, about regret and buyer's remorse. But first of all, can you talk a little bit about the research as to when we make decisions? So we think we're making a decision in time, but we're not.
Yeah. You know, this gets back a little bit to our consciousness again and how we imagine the world going. This phenomenon was first observed in the macaque monkey, which is a ubiquitous subject in neuroscience research. And when you can actually put microelectrodes in a macaque brain and actually see what neurons are firing when, what was observed, this is a number of years ago, was when a food item was placed in reach of a macaque sitting in an apparatus, and of course their response is to reach for the food and eat the food. What they noticed is that the part of the motor system that was activating the reaching movement actually fired before the part of the brain that registers awareness that there's food there. Now, that seems weird because, again, we think from inside our own consciousness, stuff comes into our sense receptors, we process it, we decide something about it, and then we make an action. And this sort of flew in the face of that. So people say, well, is this true in humans as well? And so someone, I think I can't remember the authors, damn it, very ingenious experiment where they put people in an MRI scanner. They had a button in front of each index finger. And they said, what we'd like you to do is at some point in time decide to push either the right-hand button or the left-hand button. You just decide and push it. And while they're looking, while they're doing this, there are letters flashing on a screen. And they said, what we'd like you to do is, what letter was on the screen when you decided to push the button? Okay. Now, again, they can act at their own time. They can choose either the right button or the left button. And they're monitoring their cerebral activity while they're doing this. And actually, they're measuring blood flow, which, as some of you who know about MRI stuff, is sort of late compared to when stuff actually happens, because the blood is bringing oxygen into a part of the brain that's been activated for some reason. So what they find is that they could predict which button somebody was going to push about 7 seconds before they decided to push it. And because the blood flow was happening 7 seconds before the decision, actually that means the actual activation in their brain was actually probably about 10 seconds before they decided. Now that just seems completely absurd to all of us, because we really think about the idea that the way we go through life is we're making decisions about acting. But if you think about it for a minute, if you think about all the things that you do, I mean, when to pick up your water bottle or your glass of beer or whatever it happens to be, if we had to consciously decide everything that we do in the course of a day, we would be exhausted after we were awake for an hour, right? Because there's just too many things to choose as we go through a day.
And you see this sort of behavior in all sorts of situations. And we've talked about this a little bit on the show before, but if you look at, for example, store buying behavior, but buying behavior at the grocery store. So if you, on a typical trip to the grocery store, you might buy 50 items, okay? Now, if you actually had to deliberate about each choice of those 50 choices, and that deliberation took, I don't know, 30 seconds each, well, just for 50 items, that's 25 minutes of deliberation and choice time, not to mention walking from one place to another in the store. You'd be at the grocery store for hours, right, if that's what you were doing. But if you actually look at what people are doing, they're running through the store and grabbing essentially what they bought last time. And one of the ways you can see this is if you have one of those little loyalty cards at a store, the reason they give you that loyalty card is not because they like you so much.
What?
It's because they're tracking you. And they're tracking your purchases over time. And by using the loyalty card, they can see what you buy over time. And then they use that to predict, for example, what is the effect of, you know, lowering the price of a particular orange juice by a nickel on purchases. Well, in order to analyze that data, the first thing they have to do is to pull out a source of variability in the choices that they affectionately refer to as brand loyalty, which is basically doing what you did last time. And most of the choice behavior that you see in those sets is accounted for by that aspect of choice. It's almost entirely doing what you did last time. And of course, that's not necessarily your awareness of this. You go into the situation thinking, I'm shopping. You're not shopping. You're pulling the stuff you always buy off the shelves and into your cart.
Yeah. And we should probably say one more thing about this as you bring up grocery stores. There's sort of an intuitive notion that the more choices we have, the better it is. And actually, many of you recognize that that's not true. More is not better. It's just more. And sometimes more is worse because there are too many things to have to choose from. For those of us who deal with healthcare issues and those kinds of things, when I would sign my mother up for her Medicare drug plan, I would go on the website and would be overwhelmed by the number of choices that there were. Right? Now, of course, in an abstract, you think, well, more choices is better because that gives you more choices. Right. But that means there are more things that I need to learn about before I can make an informed decision. So one way to actually befuddle people and get them to lead to the decision that you'd like them to come to is to give more choices. Right? I mean, you know, if you've ever tried to shop for a phone plan, with one company from another, you realize the plans are basically incomparable because this one gives free minutes for this thing and another thing has an over minute thing and this rolls over to next month and they're all different. So I can't possibly process all that information, but I just saw a Verizon commercial. Verizon, right? And so the actual, in those instances, the confusion is actually the advantage to the seller because you just can't possibly process all the information.
What about then expert decision making? Like, are there certain people who we can trust because they can make decisions better than the average Joe?
Well, politicians certainly, and then
I trust them. Yes,
clearly.
Of course. Well, but one of the things about decision making, though, is that it isn't a thing, right? That is, there isn't going to be a person who is an expert decision maker. What you really have are people who have expertise in a particular area. And one of the things we've talked about on the show quite a bit is there isn't really a general intelligence either that matters. Almost everything of importance is what we've learned to do. And so the reason that we want to find experts we can trust in particular domains is because those people have specific knowledge that they can use to help us to make choices. And so finding trusted advisors in domains is really important, provided that the domain itself is important enough to have an advisor. So one thing that I think is really important to talk about is that one of the fundamental principles that we go through life with when we make choices is that we are trying to devote the right amount of effort to choices given the importance of being accurate in that particular choice, right? So you don't want to spend 45 minutes deliberating over which ice cream to buy. Because that's just a lot of time.
Well, what kind of ice cream?
Any kind of ice cream. Just grab one. Because basically any ice cream experience is a good ice cream experience. So you're going to do well enough. But if you're trying to decide what car to buy or what house to buy, then you probably want to put a little bit more effort into it than that because you're going to live with the consequences of that decision. And so we want to match the effort to the required accuracy. And that also goes for when do we want to find an expert to help us to make the choice. We probably don't need an expert to guide us through the ice cream menu.
I don't know. I have had buyer's remorse from ice cream before.
Was that a pun?
An ice cream experience.
You know, buyer's is an ice cream, you know. Did you mean that?
Briars. That's buyer's remorse.
No, it was a buyer's.
I wish I was smart enough for that one. But let's talk about buyer's remorse and decisions and happiness and how we, you know, how we can be okay with the decisions that we make even though we're not really conscious that we're making them.
Well, can I say one thing before that? I know I'm going to screw up.
Do whatever you want. Okay. You always do
it. Okay. And that is, you know, when you're thinking about the decisions that we make, there are ways to influence people to help them make better decisions. And Art started talking about this thing, and I'm a musician, so it's a recapitulation happening here, about, you know, we want to help people make better decisions when we're doing this, right? And most of the times when we want people to make a decision, the easier we make it for them to make a good decision, the more likely it will be to make the decision. And one of the great examples is retirement plans, which Art mentioned about. You know, I mean, I think many people, especially young people, would say, well, you know, I'm going to be old a long time from now, and right now I need the money, so why would I be socking that money away?
And then suddenly you're old.
And then suddenly you're old. Right, as are we. So, but I think one of the things that's sort of interesting about that is that we don't allow people to decide when they come into a new company or a new business or the university, would you like to have a retirement plan? We ask the question, which retirement plan would you like? Which is a whole different kind of question, right? And so the interesting thing about it is from the part of the actor, you, the employee, whatever, you do have a choice. But what's interesting is what choices you're allowed to make, right? You're not allowed to decide whether to save for your retirement. We've already decided that. right? But we will let you decide which among these several plans you can opt in, into. And, you know, an example I would use for this, you know, when our grandchildren were much younger and we used to babysit our grandchildren, we would ask them, where would you like to get ready for bed? You want to put your pajamas on in your bedroom or in the living room? We didn't ask the question, are you ready for bed? Because we've already decided that you're going to bed, right? So now there are choices that we will allow you to make so you can feel like you're making a choice, but we've decided what choices those will be.
And just to push buyer's remorse off for one more second.
I don't even care.
There's another piece to this, too, that's really nice.
Actually, can you tell? We don't want to talk about that. Sorry.
We're going to feel bad once we do. But there's some really wonderful studies also on defaults. Okay, so that is not mortgage defaults, but actually default options. So one of the things that happens, a lot of times you notice that they give you an option and one of them is already pre-selected for you, but then you could opt out of that and choose something else. And it turns out basically everybody sticks with the one that's been chosen for them, particularly in complicated situations. And the reason for that is because often you assume that whoever set those defaults must know what's best for you, and you'd better know something special if you're going to opt out of that. Now, here's the thing. There was a really interesting natural experiment that got done with this that involved auto insurance. So everyone has to get auto insurance. And in neighboring states, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, there was a potential rider on your auto insurance in which you could, for a lower rate, you could give up your right to sue in certain situations, okay? In one state, the option was that you would pay the higher rate and retain your right to sue. In the other state, you were paying the default was you were going to pay the lower rate and give up your right to sue. So they had different defaults in each state. And if you looked ultimately at what people chose to do, the majority of people in each state went with the default, which means nobody had a clue what they were supposed to do. And so they just stuck with what was the default option. But what this means for us, I mean, that's a little bit sad, but what this means for us is, if you're trying to influence people's decisions, one of the other things that you want to do is to pick the thing that you really believe is the best thing for them and make that the default, so that people would have to opt out of that and opt into doing the thing that you think is worse for them, because most people will end up going along with that default.
This is like making kidney donation the default.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But I'm still using it.
You can have it for a while. This opens up this huge conversation about climate change, democracy, all of these wonderful things. But I get asked these guys questions all the time, like I say. So you don't. So why doesn't Amy Chambliss has a microphone and she is going to be coming around? And so just raise your hand if you have a question, because I know there are tons of questions, perhaps. There's one right up here in the front.
Miss McEnroy, Christopher, once again, I always ask the first question. One of the things that I'm interested in is you say that perhaps we don't understand choices or decisions. May I ask the simple question of subliminal advertising?
Yeah, subliminal advertising. So the idea behind subliminal advertising, let's break this down. The idea behind subliminal perception is that we can become we can be influenced by things that appear to us too quickly for us to recognize that we actually saw them. And that actually exists, okay? It really is the case that if I flash something at you at like 16 milliseconds, preceded and succeeded by noise, by visual noise, you will actually, your brain will register that information and be influenced by it, okay? So,
and not be aware that you
and
saw
not, it. And you're not aware that you saw it. You are influenced by something without your awareness that you saw it. Now, in the context of advertising, what can that do? And the answer is not a lot. What these subliminal presentations do is that they increase the activity in information related to what was flashed to you. So I can't teach you something new subliminally. what I can do is to increase the level of activation of something you already know about based on this subliminal presentation. So if I flashed a Coca-Cola logo at you, I could make you somewhat more prone to purchase Coca-Cola than something else, assuming that you already knew about all of these brands of soda and that this was something that was in your repertoire of purchasing. So it's not going to make you do something you would never, ever do. And it's not going to make you do something that involves something you've never heard of. But it can bias you towards a particular option relative to others. But it's no more effective to do that than just to show people a bunch of ads, right? So it's not more powerful. In fact, it's less powerful. If you're Coca-Cola, subliminal advertising torques people off when they find out that you've done it to them, and then they get angry at you, and that's never good for your product. So rather than do something that has a small effect that's going to anger people, do something that has a bigger effect that people are actually perfectly happy with, like advertising.
And I think usually we think about something subliminal as being somehow technologically presented, right? But of course, we're more attracted to things often depending on where they are on the shelf in a store, right? And you could say in some ways that's subliminal advertising, because I don't know, I'm responding to the fact that it's easier to reach than somebody that's farther down or higher up. So the idea about subliminal having to have some technological whiz-bang thing that flashes something really fast, I would suggest that all the things that we respond to that we don't realize we're responding to are in fact subliminal.
Or at least unconscious. Yeah. And one of the greatest ones of these that I really love is there's all this work now on what's called embodied cognition, right? Which means that you, the state of your body and the things you can do with your body influence what you're thinking about. So think about going to Costco and buying the gigantic things of toilet paper, right? I mean, like 900 rolls all at once. The problem with a lot of those big packages is you can't figure out how to pick it up because it's too big. It turns out that if you make it easier for people to see how to pick it up by making an easily accessible, invisible handle, you make that brand more likely to be purchased. Now, nobody thinks I'm buying this because it's obvious how to pick it up. But in fact, that's what happens. You understand how to interact with it viscerally. Your body understands how to interact with it, and that affects the choice that you make. I love that.
To quote Art Markman, most of us have no idea what we're doing most of the time.
Another question.
Hey, my name's Dan. So my question is, and you just started to touch on it, is about environment. You know, like when you're at a casino, there's no windows and they're pumping in oxygen. You go to Whole Foods and oh my God, everything is amazing and everything is crafted. And I'm wondering if you could talk about environment, because I think environment plays a huge part in how you make a decision.
Yeah. Environment drives huge amounts of behavior. The simple principle is this: human beings do what's easiest to do. And so in decision-making situations, if you have control over the environment, your principle is make the thing you desire people to do easy to do, make the things you don't want them to do hard to do. And that is an enormous amount of what goes on in decision making.
And of course, the way we feel about things has a great deal of influence on whether we choose to act or not as well. You know, you mentioned casinos. It's against the law for a casino to manipulate a slot machine, for example. And they would get in a huge amount of trouble with that. But it's not illegal for them to monitor a slot machine. And you might think that the people who are walking around a casino floor, you know, handing out tickets for free drinks or a steak dinner are just kind of randomly doing that. They're not randomly doing it at all. So if you've been hanking on that lever for a lot of time and you haven't hit the jackpot yet, and you're at the point where data from past experiences would let a casino know you're about to stop, that's the time to go give you a free drink ticket. And now you think, oh, I just got a free drink ticket. And now you're yanking the handle again. Now, the free drink ticket has nothing to do with that, right? But now what the casino doesn't want you to do is develop an association between this, you know, lousy feeling that I'm pumping quarters or half dollars or whatever into this thing and nothing's coming out. So we'll just think about something else. It's happy. And now I have a happy association with sitting in front of this machine, even though the drink ticket has nothing to do with what I'm doing. And now I'm much more likely to continue to participate than I would be just based on the data I'm getting from the machine that seems to be ignoring me, except taking my quarters.
Wow. Another question?
So there's sort of like this insane rabbit hole you can go down, right? Where
you
ask your kids like, where do you want to put on your pajamas, right? And there's an analogous thing that happens here with the sort of discourse of democracy that happens in this country, right? You say like, well, either it's this thing or it's that thing. And you hear that in the discourse and you think, okay, that's going to frame the way I think about this situation, but really there are many other ways to think about the situation. You just don't take the time to question the sort of dichotomies that are presented.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't really have a question per se, but like to what extent does this shape the way that political thinking happens in sort of the big sphere? And like, is it sort of intentionally done or is it just something that happens just because...
See, I sense that underneath all that, you're asking us to explain Donald Trump. Yeah. Is that what you're...
But it turns out we're not that kind of psychologists.
I mean, you bring up an interesting thing about the way decisions are framed, right? Because framing effects are huge, right? There's a... We've mentioned many times on the show, Daniel Kahneman, one of the great psychologists with his partner, Amos Tversky. And Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in economics, for God's sake. He's a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize in economics. But one of the things that's really interesting about his approach to this is recognizing how the way you frame questions has a tremendous influence on the decisions that people will make. And I won't go through any experiments here, but if you convey a choice or an array of choices in a particular way, you could design that in a way that you can influence what people are likely to choose depending on how you frame the choice. Now, this is what political consultants are for, right? I mean, and if you think about it, really, the language that we use in political discourse is constructed in such a way that we make associations with things in ways that the people who are using the language want us to make. I mean, if you think about the abortion debate, which has gone on many times, long time in this country, people who are anti-abortion don't describe themselves as that. They describe themselves as pro-life, right? And people who think people should have a right to an abortion don't think that they're pro-abortion. They're pro-choice. And so that language, right, depending on which side of the issue you're on, influences the way, potentially, the way people view either side of the debate, because one is a positive pro thing and one is an anti-negative thing. And we do this all the time just in common conversations, right? And it influences, I think, the way we think and feel about things much more than most of us recognize.
And the language that we use for lots of decision-making situations really has such a profound impact on what we think even the goal is for the choice that we're making. So one of the ones that I find really interesting was a discussion I was having with physicians, right? So think about the war on cancer, right? Well, when you say we have a war on cancer, well, when you have a war on anything, you're right, then what you do is you beat that thing. That's what you're supposed to do. And so you're supposed to destroy the cancer. But it turns out medically there are other options, right? What if rather than beating the cancer, which can often the treatments to do that are really debilitating, what if you just managed it? So you treated certain cancers as if they're just long-term diseases that aren't lethal, but you've always got them. And that's actually, for some cancers, that is probably the best treatment for it. But because we declare war on it, that's not an option that anyone considers. So the entire frame of the choice creates a set of beliefs about what the options are supposed to be.
The war on terror works so well.
Yes.
Oh my God, I'm terrible.
It's a whole other show.
Next question, right up here.
So I'm thinking, hi, I'm Frances. So I'm thinking about gun violence in the country and the word safety. So if you think of safety as protecting my family, or you think of safety as protecting the whole community, do you have any thoughts on how this works of using that particular thing of whether you in fact buy a gun or not? Though I know some people are more likely to do that because it's in their history, they're more familiar with it, but the increase of guns in the United States can't be accounted for just for that. And the whole public health debate around safety and how that's interpreted by different people, I'm just interested in whether you think that relates in any way to this.
Well, it does, and there are, I'll let Art start this thing.
Oh, okay. Well, it's, so I think one of the big things with this is to remember that a lot of these decisions are made on these other grounds, and then the language gets put on them later. So if you think about in the case of guns, for example, well, the more guns you see, the more that they become an accessible concept in your environment, the more normalized they become, and consequently, the more that it seems like something one would go and own. And when you combine that with a certain amount of fear or anxiety, creates a desire to say, own a gun. At that point, you've already, you know, that decision in some ways has already been made. And then we put all this other language on top of that. And of course, what happens is we then interpret words to fit the decision we've made. So now, if you've already basically decided you're buying a gun, safety now means protecting my homestead, protecting my community, being safe in the event of a disaster. And if I've already decided I'm not going to buy a gun on the basis of these factors, now safety means I don't feel like I would be in a safe situation if I owned a gun. So you actually interpret the words to fit the decision, the preference you've already created.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think one thing about this, you know, and the gun debate has been going on in the United States for a long time, of course, but you know, it sort of illustrates how much of our decision making is based on emotionality, right? I mean, there's an interesting thing about how different people respond differently to the idea of order and following the rules and those kinds of things. And you know, it was an article that came out, I don't know if you all remember this, but sometime last spring or something, there was a guy who robbed a Waffle House in North Carolina, and the guy that was unlucky enough to be as we robbed the Waffle House, that there was an off-duty cop at the drive-thru window, so he came in with a gun, he robbed the thing, he's leaving the store with the cash drawer under his arm
and waffles
and the guy comes around the front of the store, the cop comes around the store, and he shoots him and kills him. And they were describing this whole thing about what's going on, you know. And the last line of the article that the sheriff in the town, I don't remember the name of the town, said, well, at least nobody was hurt. the reason I remember that so much is that it speaks to what our perceptions are about what, first of all, what safety means, and the fact that you can certainly get people to act if there is a believable threat, and then people take action. But of course, the emotional salve that comes with having a weapon that you own doesn't really think through to, okay, so now I'm in my house and I hear a noise, and now what am I going to do? Or I'm walking on the street and somebody threatening is coming toward me, and what am I going to do? Because we're not required to go all the way through to that final thing, right? We're just thinking about, I have the gun, guns are safe, I've got a gun, now I feel protected. And it's a whole different attitude that's apart from the actual behavior you would have to execute to wield the weapon.
And I, one thing that I think is really important to point out in this is, you know, because is this cuts across political lines. I think, you know, when you frame this just in terms of guns, you know, because there's a very strong left-right difference politically in who tends to be in favor of gun ownership, one of the things we have to recognize is we get this on you know, in on all sorts of issues. So this is true for vaccination, which is, you know, so that the anti-vaccination folks you know, are responding on the basis of a set of emotions about a choice that then affects not just the health of their child, but also the health of the entire community, particularly when diseases that we thought had been eradicated start to come back into the population. And the demographics of who does and doesn't vaccinate are very different from the demographics of who does and doesn't want to own guns. So I raise this to make it clear. There are times where you get into thinking about one of these things and think, well, this is a reflection of a particular political persuasion. Yeah. And it really isn't. It's a reflection of humanity and how we approach these kinds of emotion-laden situations.
Yeah. Another question? We have time for about two more questions.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to thank you for bringing up the concept of the functional MRI, and I suspect the day is not too far away when we will have an app on our phone. We will be wired to some degree wirelessly, and we'll be able to, when we have a difficult decision or a crisis or an interpersonal problem going, we could look at the fMRI and go, oh, that's what's going on. So. All right, I'm going to do this. What?
That doesn't make me feel one bit better. I got to tell you.
There will
also
be an app.
Also glad you brought up the evolutionary development of the brain and the layers and so on and all that are influencing our decisions. I didn't want Aaron T. Beck and that whole concept of automatic thoughts to pass by this conversation because it's so important and I've found it so useful in my life. To become aware that I'm constantly being motivated internally, quietly, by very subtle, maybe distant things, or maybe a present emotional things, associations. And so this concept of automatic thoughts, if you can become aware of them, it really goes a long way. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah,
yeah.
Great show.
You bet. Yeah. You know, I just say one thing about that, about how important it is that most of our behavior runs on automatic pilot. Because as we were saying earlier, we couldn't function if that weren't the case. That many of the things that we're doing because below our conscious awareness, we're just kind of acting in ways that allow us to actually live a pretty happy life. The difficulty comes when the things that we're not actually aware of are pushing us in ways that are disadvantageous in the long term. I mean, Art mentioned early on, you know, we evolve to respond to stuff that's this far in the future. You know, I mean, early hominids did not need retirement accounts, right? I mean, what they needed was food.
Must
now.
Save rocks.
Yeah, what they needed was food now, and that you know, member of the Office of Sex looks lovely. That's about as deep as anything got. You know, but now we have all this other stuff to deal with, and I think you know our species has been remarkably resourceful in figuring out ways to deal with things that are pushing us in directions that are not to our long-term advantage, right? But it seems like that one of the things that we can do for ourselves and for our children and other people that we care about, right, is understand more deeply what the potential is for us to respond to things that we don't really recognize we're responding to in a way that allows us to make better decisions for ourselves and people we care about in the long term.
But isn't it true that a lot of the things that are automatic now, we have learned, like driving
a car? Oh,
sure, of course, you know? Yeah.
And that the process of learning, we forget.
Well, right. So something I said often is that when I teach big classes in cognitive psychology, I try to remind people that the brain is designed as much as possible not to think. So what you really want to do is to take all of the things that you do over and over and over again and turn them into automatized routines that habit system that's buried deep in the brain can carry out all by itself. So many of those habits that we have, some of them reflect evolutionary wiring. So as Bob was talking about, there are some things that, you know, we evolutionarily wanted high fat, high salt foods. But then there are other things that we just learn to do, and, you know, driving, for example, is a great example, or you know, actually one of the things that drives us all crazy now is smartphone behavior, right? So we have all learned a set of habits that now get us checking our smartphone about every 10 to 12 minutes on average, because that's about how long it takes before something interesting, some new interesting cat video has come in again. And so that's a learned behavior. But even though it's a learned behavior, very quickly, we can't get through the day without it, right? And so suddenly you find yourself reaching for your pocket, grabbing the phone again, because that's the habit that you've learned.
It's important to think about what drives that habit and what keeps it going and what makes it so damn hard to change. And it is precisely the same thing that our brains evolved to do when we're dealing with environments that have nothing to do with smartphones or anything like that. And the reason that our smartphones are so compelling, right, to get to us is their unpredictability, right? I mean, one of the things that we know about everything that we experience is that our brains are efficient, and another word for efficient is lazy. And what brains learned over evolutionary time is things that aren't changing probably aren't important. Things that change probably matter, right? Like most of you in the room right now probably have stopped hearing the fan of the HVAC system. But now you hear it. Some of you could still hear it, but a lot of you, it went out of your, why? Because it's not changing, right? And if you're walking out on the savanna as an early hominid, you know, and the wind is wafting through the, you know, the brush and whatever, and it's not really changing very much, you don't pay attention to that. But when you hear a loud crack of a piece of wood, and it's a low pitch, so it must have been a big piece of wood, and that meant something big had to break the piece of wood, you orient to that, right? And now instead of big pieces of wood that might, you know, be connected to a saber-toothed tiger, now you got a little ding, and you think, wow, what was that? And the thing is, sometimes when it dings, it's actually interesting. And because it's not always interesting, you're that much more compelled to look at it. If you knew it was always Fred, you know, then whenever it thinks it's Fred again, you wouldn't even get out of your pocket, right? But the fact that you don't know, it might be Jacob. Oh, and so now you have a much greater need, literally a need, to get the damn thing out of your pocket because of the unpredictability of the response.
And then once you have the habit, the other problem is habits are memories. They're memories. Now, you can't stop yourself from retrieving a memory, right? You know, we've all played this game before, but let's just try this. For the next 5 or 10 seconds, everybody in the room is allowed to think of anything they want, anything at all, but I don't want anyone to think about white elephants, okay? Go. Right? Whole room full of people going, white elephants, stop. White, I can't stop. Because you can't stop yourself from pulling things out of memory. And so that habit, even when you tell yourself, even when those frontal lobes say, I'm done, I've got to stop doing this, the habit system keeps retrieving that, and before you know it, there it is, it's Jacob again.
I have no idea who Jacob
is. I don't know, but he's getting a lot of good press today. Yeah.
Well, let's take one last question. What do you think? Where's Jack? There he is.
Hi there, I'm Anne Marie. I guess I'm looking for a little advice. I'm curious about how to influence the decision-making of others. For instance, I'm applying for a lot of jobs right now and doing a lot of in-person interviews. So maybe not from the perspective of advertising, but how do I influence decisions interpersonally?
Yeah. Amy Cuddy.
Yeah, great.
Well, no. okay. So one of the things, though, that's really important to do when you're trying to influence other people's decisions is to fit with what their goals are already, right? So one of the things we know about decisions is it's very hard to get people to decide to do something that is far from what they already want to do, right? So the trick in making, you know, so if you look at people who are trained in sales, you know, part of what you do is you never ask a yes, no question, right? Because you want to keep people talking. But part of what you're trying to do is to lead people closer and closer towards from where they are to make small decisions towards where you want them to be. So that means you can't get people to go a large distance, which means that if you're, for example, in a job situation and you're trying to get someone to decide that you're the one, part of what you need to know is what do they want? I mean, what do they really already want to do? And then if it turns out that you present yourself in a way that choosing you for that job allows them to do the thing that they basically already want to do, then you're in great shape.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so final thoughts on choice, decision making, and happiness.
Yeah.
We're never going to get there. this is my life.
We'll do a show on buyer's remorse. You want to?
Sure. You know, I think a lot of well, actually, you know, I can actually relate this to buyer's remorse. How about that?
I wish I'd done that.
And if you think about this just in general in terms of regret, you know, because buyer's remorse is a form of regret. You know, I did that. Ugh, wish I'd done that instead. You know, we've all been there, you know. And I think a lot of times when we're presented with options, we don't imagine how many of those options would be quite satisfying. Because we want the best option, right? So there are five things that we could choose. I want to get the best one. Well, you know, I might be very happy with four of the five options. There might be one that's best, but I would be happy with the fourth best and be very happy, you know? The fifth one, no. But when you think about that, I think what makes a lot of people regret decisions that they make is to think that they missed out on what was perceived to be, in hindsight, the best one, right? And the thing is, basically, we're adaptable creatures, human beings, and we can be happy in a lot of different circumstances, in a lot of different ways. Not all circumstances, not always, but a lot of circumstances, a lot of different ways. And once you let go of the idea that I want to be sure I got the best one, right? And you say, look, there are a lot of things here that are quite lovely, and I picked a lovely one, and I'm happy about that. Now, that's hard to do because we also, deep in our brains, are prone to comparing what we got with what other people got, right? And much of the misery in the world is based on Art's got a better thing than I've got, whatever that happens to be. He's got a better job. He's got a higher salary. You know, I like his coat better. I mean, whatever, right?
That's a nice coat.
I don't know. Actually, it's better than yours. But I think I'm trying to be nice. But when you really think about it. Yeah, I know. So when you really think about, you know, there are lots of options that are satisfying and potentially rewarding, you now let go of that sort of thinking back and revisiting in a way that's not usually productive.
And so what I want to say is something slightly different, because his answer is better than mine. But I'm going to do the best I can to muddle through. So
be satisfied.
There you go. But there's also, I mean, we talked a lot about this notion of framing. And one of the things that fascinates me about a lot of the choices that we make is that we actually frame our own choices in ways that constrain how they're going to come out before we even make them. We paint ourselves into a corner. And the problem with painting yourself into a corner is that often your beliefs about the way things are going to go next, particularly in life, are limited by your lack of imagination, right? You aren't always able to envision the great thing that could happen next. And in many ways, I find this show to be an example of that. Not the fact that we get to do that we did this show tonight, but the fact that we're doing this thing at all. Because we started this at a Views and Brews about 4 years ago, five years ago. We came in and we did a Views and Brews, and it was great fun. And Rebecca was kind enough to invite us to come back again. And when we showed up to do that, she looked at us and said, "Hey, I talked to some of the people at the station. You guys want a show?" I know this for a fact. Neither Bob nor I ever, ever, ever thought we would be on the radio doing a show. Never. And right. And if we were on the radio, we'd be on once, and then people would have gone, "Yeah, never again." So we never considered it. But yet, both of us sort of went, "Yeah, okay, sure. Why not?" And then some fun stuff happened as a result of that. And I think if we had constrained ourselves to think about that choice in terms of what we had already envisioned for how life was supposed to go, we would have missed out on something. And I think that's important, right? You can't let your own set of beliefs about how the way things should go get in the way of the way your life actually goes.
Yeah. Very nice.
See, look at that.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Yours was still better.
Well, as this is a show on psychology, I have to end with a quote from Freud. Bob's favorite. And which is the key to life is meaningful work and meaningful relationships. And thank God I have both with both of you guys. And you all make it possible because you come out and support what we do. So thank you so much for coming out tonight and continuing to listen to Two Guys on Your Head. Please come out to our next Views and Brews, which is February 9th. It will be on some great crazy jazz thing that we're doing with Neil. And you can find this podcast pretty soon up on iTunes. Just search for Views and Brews, and also it will be on Two Guys on Your Head. And have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Good night.
I'm going to take your picture.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.